Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
In January of 2010, a 7.1 magnitude earthquake rocked the small island nation of Haiti, causing utter devastation, resulting in the deaths of over 300,000 people and leaving over a million injured and/or homeless. Governments and religious aid organizations around the world responded with food, water, clothing, and other forms of aid. While this natural disaster put the difficult plight of Haitians front and center in the news cycle for several weeks that followed, what often went unmentioned was that Haitians have been struggling with abject poverty caused by decades of government mismanagement and corruption. In fact, Haiti ranks as one of the poorest nations in the Western Hemisphere, with a GDP per capita of approximately $1,200, even before the earthquake hit. In comparison, the neighboring Dominican Republic, which shares the Caribbean island with Haiti, has a GDP per capita roughly seven times higher. Not surprisingly, such economic conditions, combined with a history of political tyranny, forced many Haitians to flee to other nations, including the United States, Canada, and France, over the past several decades. And for any immigrants, especially ones running from very difficult economic circumstances, integrating into the new society can be a major challenge. While religious organizations have shown their ability to provide disaster relief to people living in Haiti, have they provided similar assistance to those who have fled the country over the years? Are some religious organizations better suited for helping immigrants adopt and assimilate to these new countries? And what factors determine whether a religious group will be successful in assisting such people in need? Those are the questions we're taking up today with Professor Margarita Mooney. Professor Mooney is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where she also serves as a faculty fellow at the Carolina Population Center. There she specializes in issues related to international migration, aging, religion, and education. She's the author of a recent book, Faith Makes Us Live, Surviving and Thriving in the Haitian Diaspora, which I should note was published just prior to the recent earthquake in Haiti. And as usual, we'll have links to this book and Professor Mooney's personal website at Research on Religion, so I invite you to head on over there and check it out. And while you're there, we're also going to ask you to use our new social media features on our site to help us spread the word via Facebook, Twitter, and all these other sorts of wonderful apps, many of which I don't understand, but you probably do. Margarita, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you very much, Tony.
Hey, my first question for you is, have you linked up to Research on Religion on Facebook?
Absolutely, and I also plan on linking it to my course website in Sociology of Religion so my students can hear the wonderful podcast.
Oh, that is awesome. That's a lesson for everybody. If it's good enough for a professor at the University of North Carolina, then it's good enough for everybody else. So I'm also saying that, too, because we have a frequent listener in Moose Jaw, Canada, and I'm not going to rest I'm not gonna get good solid sleep until I know that everybody in the town of Moose Jaw, Canada, is connected with us via Facebook. So,
sounds great.
All right, we should get down to more serious business here. We got a lot to cover today. Your book, which we'll be discussing today, was essentially your dissertation while you're at Princeton, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Now, in this work, you're examining how religious communities in three separate cities in three different countries, Miami, Montreal, and Paris, assist Haitian immigrants adjust to their new world. For the benefit of some of our graduate students and even undergraduate students or people just curious out there, I was wondering if you could give us an idea how you came up with that project. Where do graduate students come up with these ideas for dissertation topics?
Well, that's an excellent question. Initially, I was interested in studying immigrant incorporation in different countries that have different ideas for how immigrants should assimilate culturally. And I decided to focus on religion in part because I was interested in the contrast between the importance given to religion as a tool for immigrant incorporation in the U.S., but religion being seen as such a problem or perhaps even an impediment to immigrant incorporation in France. So I actually picked Haitians as a case to study because they're a Francophone, and, well, they also speak Haitian Creole, but they had been a French colony, so there was an immigrant community of Haitians in both of the countries that the research question I was interested in on. And it was only later that I found out that there's also a large community of the Haitian diaspora in Montreal, which provided another fascinating case for the same question because of the debates around religion and national identity, and more recently, religion and immigrant incorporation in Quebec. So that's how I came to be interested in Haitians, was really because of the three countries that I wanted to compare and contrast on how religion is seen as a part of immigrant incorporation.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned religion, too, because one thing that you note in your book is that a lot of immigrant studies don't necessarily focus on the topic of religion. So what took you in that direction?
Well, interestingly, I had taken several classes on international migration, and there was not at that time, which was about 10 years ago now, there was not much focus on religion. The literature on international migration to the U.S. focused on labor market incorporation, access to education, language acquisition, and other forms of social integration. But when I went back to some of the classical works on immigrant incorporation, such as Oscar Handlin or Will Herberg, there were lots of references to how immigrants' religious institutions accompanied immigrants along all of those other measures of social integration that I just mentioned, labor markets, education, language. So this idea of religious institutions being at the center of immigrant and ethnic communities was very prominent in research on immigration to the U.S. through the 1930s up to the 1960s, but it really only started to come back into focus at the time that I began my dissertation research around 2000. So I was one of several scholars that helped bring attention back to the importance that religious communities often have for immigrant incorporation in the U.S. as well as elsewhere.
This has been a constant theme throughout our podcast interviews over the past year and a half, where a lot of scholars working in the area of criminology or happiness studies or other types of social issues types of topics are rediscovering religion. That, you know, 50, 60 years ago, it became part of the academic dialogue, but then faded away, and now we're part of a general generation here that's rediscovering a lot of that. I think that's rather fascinating. Let me talk about Haiti, and some of our listeners might not be all that familiar with it, given that it doesn't receive a great deal of attention in the news unless there is some kind of major disaster. For the benefit of our listeners, could you give us a brief history of Haiti?
Sure. Like many of the listeners to this program, I really began this research with not a lot of knowledge about Haiti. I knew that it was a French colony, and I knew that it was in the Caribbean next to the Dominican Republic, not far from Cuba. But I didn't know much about the political and economic, cultural, religious conditions in Haiti. So actually, in my book, there's a short appendix that describes Haitian history more or less through the Haitian Revolution, which finished in 1804, up to the present. And some important things to keep in mind, first of all, is the Haitian Revolution. Haiti shares with the U.S., having become independent from its colonizer, in the case of Haiti, France, very early on. So in fact, the Haitian Revolution sought to establish a republic, an independent republic for black citizens. It was the first republic of black citizens in the world. So Haitians are very proud of their long independence and for having had this republican constitution for such a long time. That said, after the Haitian Revolution, there was a lot of division amongst the new Haitian leaders about the direction that the nation should take. And there was also it took a very long time for the rest of the Western Hemisphere, as well as Europe, to acknowledge the independence of Haiti, because there was a fear that this type of slave revolt against a colonial power could happen in other places. So Haiti wasn't really on the international map until six decades after its independence in 1804.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, there was a lot of internal division and a lot of conflict as well with the neighboring Dominican Republic. So after that, Haiti began to develop economically, but it was mostly an agricultural economy, and Haitians worked mostly in cultivating rice or sugarcane, and many Haitians traveled to neighboring Dominican Republic or Cuba to work on sugarcane fields. So migration has long been a part of Haitian history, but what was new was migration to the United States and Canada and France. Prior to around the 1970s, the only Haitians who migrated were mostly students and intellectuals who chose to study in mostly Francophone, French-speaking universities and places. So there's a long historical tie between Haiti and France, as well as between Haiti and Quebec. These ties are also very much mediated through the Catholic Church. Catholicism in Haiti came along with the French missionaries, and in fact, many of the slaves who were brought to Haiti had already been converted to Christianity prior to arriving in the New World. So Haitian religion developed as a bit of a mixture between Catholicism as well as African religious practices and beliefs. So Catholicism as well as Haitian voodoo are very prevalent. Protestantism was very small in Haiti up until recent missionary activity that accelerated a lot around the 1970s as well. So these three religious groups, Catholicism, voodoo, and Protestantism, make up the religious landscape of Haiti. And Catholicism, through the religious orders that taught in Haiti, that ran agricultural cooperatives, that worked in social development, politics, all of those religious orders have very strong ties to France and Quebec. So the intellectuals in Haiti have very strong ties to both Catholicism and to Quebec and to France. Migration from Haiti to the U.S. began mostly to New York and only really accelerated to Miami in the 1970s, when those Haitians who used to migrate to work on sugarcane fields and other parts of the Caribbean started moving to Miami. So the Haitian community in Miami grew so rapidly from about 1980 to 2000, from a community of just a few thousand people to a community well over a quarter of a million by around 2000. So today, Miami is the largest city of the Haitian diaspora, but that's a very recent fact. Prior to that, it was mostly Paris and Montreal, and as well as a smaller community in New York.
It's interesting that you talk about two different categories of immigrants. Prior to the 1970s, you do get the basically middle, upper middle class, wealthier intellectuals migrating for school. Some of them might stay in the cities that they're in. And then the recent one in the 1970s, particularly in the United States, which tends to be lower socioeconomic circumstances here. And that plays an important role when you talk about some of these different countries. And I personally found the chapter on Canada very interesting, because I never would associate a Haitian community with Canada. When you talk about Montreal and Quebec, of course, they speak French. But going back to those two categories of individuals, what kind of challenges do these new immigrants face? I mean, are the challenges a little bit different for the intellectual class than the mass migration of folks from lower socioeconomic parts of the latter?
Absolutely. In fact, many French-speaking Haitians who migrated to Montreal and Paris in the 1960s or 70s to study and work integrated quite easily and quite well. They spoke French, they had university degrees from the country they were moving to, and they're able to find good jobs, live in middle-class neighborhoods, and to enjoy the relative absence of racial discrimination that was so prevalent still in the United States in the 1960s and 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
However, when more working-class Haitians began to arrive in those same cities of Montreal and Paris, they were not, to begin with, fully fluent in French. The language spoken in Haiti is Haitian Creole, which of course includes a lot of French, but it's also quite different. So the number of years you have been educated in Haiti is, generally speaking, an indication of how fluent your French will be. So when Haitians began migrating to Montreal and Paris, who perhaps had only been through elementary school or perhaps even a year, one or two years of high school, they were not fluent in French to begin with. They also did not have educational credentials from the country they were migrating to, and they faced a lot of challenges in terms of finding jobs, education, housing, etc.
Yeah, are some of the challenges that some of these immigrants face from Haiti, are they fairly common to all immigrants? I just recently traced my own heritage with my son working on a genealogy merit badge. We traced my folks back to Ireland and Poland about 100 years ago, and they came over in the late 1890s, early 1900s, and I'm sure they faced a lot of difficult problems as well. What are some of these, you know, an immigrant comes into a new country, a new society, what are some of the challenges? Are these similar for all immigrants, or do Haitians face specific challenges, say, for instance, in Miami or the United States?
That's a great question. Absolutely, all immigrants face some of the same challenges in terms of getting educational credentials, either completing education in their new country or having their credentials transferred, which then is a key to labor market incorporation. They face challenges of getting their children educated, helping their children navigate the new culture as well as the home country culture. All immigrants also tend to face, you know, broken families. Families might be divided for some period of time. Not always is it that the parents and the children all come together. So there might be an extended period of separation between families. However, I would say that one barrier that Haitians faced, which is distinct from other immigrants, and it's particularly salient in the United States, is that of race. Although there are certain forms of, you could argue that there have been forms of discrimination against many kinds of immigrants, not only those of African descent, such as Haitians, in the United States, race is a more strong, it's a much stronger enduring social boundary than other forms of ethnic identity. So for Haitians migrating to Miami, their perception, well, the fact that they are mostly black of African descent, presented yet another boundary, another hurdle for them. Haitians in Montreal and Paris faced this racism to a lesser degree than in the United States, where this boundary of race is so strong. But that's not to say that race is not an important marker of difference in France and Quebec. It is, but I would say that there are also very other strong boundaries of difference in those societies. For example, in Quebec, language is an extraordinarily important marker of belonging. Haitians are francophones. They speak French. Therefore, they form part of the majority language group, which in Quebec is very important for other forms of integration.
Let me ask, too, about France, because I was interested in the discussion that you had of Paris, that, first of all, I associated Haiti with a French colony in the past, but I never associated France as having a large Haitian immigrant community. And nowadays, we tend to think of immigrant communities as being predominantly North African and Muslim in France. And if you're a Haitian immigrant that came over in the last 10 or 20 years there, I could only imagine that in the streets of Paris, people are going to look at you and say, oh, you're from Algeria or Kenya or Nigeria somewhere, right?
Well, that's partially true. Now, of course, France had a lot of colonies in Africa, both in North Africa, but also in West Africa. So there are large communities of black Africans in France as well as North Africans. So there are Senegalese, people from Côte d'Ivoire, people from Congo.
Right.
So most often when Haitians are seen in Paris, they're thought of as being from one of those countries.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you bring up an interesting point that many of the debates about immigrant incorporation in France focus on North African immigrants. But that's primarily because of their religious difference. But there are just as many. Algerians and North Africans are the largest immigrant group in France, but there are very sizable immigrant groups from Africa. But they don't get the same amount of attention because they're not perceived to be as problematic for incorporating into French culture as are North Africans, who are primarily Muslim.
Mm-hmm. Now, you bring up the religious dimension here, and this is really the crux of your book, where you focus on how religious communities can facilitate a lot of the assimilation, or if even if it's not assimilation, just assistance in trying to adapt to new circumstances. Now, while many of us have seen religious missionaries rushing off to disaster scenes, like in Haiti following the 2010 earthquake, or perhaps going to impoverished regions of the world to help with community development, dig a few wells or something like that, is there any effort by religious communities to think about missionizing or assisting people when immigrants come to them? And it's a much different process that typically we send missionaries out from the United States to Africa or to the Caribbean or Latin America. But here, the situation, this is why I really like your book and I'm interested in it, is that people are coming into the United States and all of a sudden they show up at your door. How do religious organizations deal with this?
Well, I can speak most authoritatively about the Catholic Church and immigrant integration. One of the things I learned from my research was what a long history the Catholic Church has as an institution working with immigrants in all three of the countries that I studied. Part of what explains this was the massive movement of people after World War II. So the Catholic bishops' conferences in France, as well as in Canada and the United States, made assistance to refugees from World War II a priority. So this goes back really to the 1950s. So from the top level of the Catholic Church, assisting refugees and immigrants has been one of its major social priorities for all three of these countries.
I might also say, and again, this is tracing back my history, I think the Catholic Church got a very good run-up to this in the United States by dealing with a lot of the Catholic communities that came in after the quote-unquote Protestant founding here in the United States, that you get a first wave of Irish immigrants in the 1840s, and then again in the late 1890s, you get Polish and Italian immigrants coming in as well. The Catholic Church, I know, was pretty important there too, right?
Absolutely. When you look at the history of Catholicism in the United States, Catholicism has historically has been an immigrant religion to the United States. So Polish, Italian, German, Lithuanian, all of these European ethnic Catholics who moved to the United States faced quite a bit of discrimination. I think today it's easy to forget how Catholicism was really perceived as a foreign and an un-American religion. And the Catholic Church responded in the U.S. by creating their own social system to integrate these newcomers. So the system of parishes and parish schools was a priority, and those were mostly immigrant institutions. So Silvano Tomasi and others have written about the Catholic Church and immigrants to the United States, and in large manner, Catholics became mainstream Americans largely through the social assistance given to them by Catholic institutions.
Mm-hmm. So how do these religious institutions, and I understand you're specifically talking about the Catholic Church, what kind of things can they do that eases the immigrant dilemma of trying to assimilate or to adapt to a new environment?
Well, the first thing that I discovered in my field work, I spent a lot of time living in each of these three communities. I began by interviewing leaders of each of the communities. I made a trip to each of the sites prior to doing my more extensive field work. And I became really fascinated at not just what the leaders of these communities would tell me, but I really wanted to live in each of these three Haitian communities of Miami, Montreal, and Paris, and get a sense for what the daily life of the ordinary people was like. So although I really began my research project interested in Catholicism and its institutions that support immigrant integration, by living in these communities, I came to a lot of different insights than what I had originally thought I would find. And the first insight that I found was that what makes religious communities unique is precisely that they can help bring together a group of people who have been dispersed and have left their home country either because of economic problems or, in the case of Haiti, a mixture of economic problems and the terrible political repression that occurred under the two Duvalier regimes and all the political upheaval in the attempted transitions to democracy. So the people who moved from Haiti to United States, Canada, and France had faced terrible economic and political problems prior to leaving, and most desperately, when they arrived, wanted to recreate a sense of community and a sense of belonging. So people often come to church, first of all, as a way of finding a place to center their own identity. So people would tell me in Miami, I don't know who I am when I'm separated from my church. I find myself, I know what my name is only when I'm here with other people who I can share my faith. So over and over again, I heard this theme amongst the people I spoke with in Miami. Their primary reason for attending church was not what I initially had thought, because this is a great way to access social benefits to help them with their many problems. The primary reason people told me they would go to church is, one, because of their faith and their obligation to give thanks to God, and two, for a sense of belonging and a sense of community.
That is one of the things that I did pick up in your book, and being a political scientist who focuses on religious institutions, my eyes were particularly trained on the institutional features, and we'll talk a little bit about these in a second in each of the three cases that you examine. But the other thing that is threaded throughout the entire book is this story about personal faith, and you open the book beautifully with some really vivid stories of people who are deeply faithful, and that must be an important component of being able to connect up with a religious community. What role does one's individual faith play in this process of working with a religious community to assimilate or to adapt to new environments?
Well, when I began my field work in Miami, I wanted to do interviews with people and find out about how they helped their children get enrolled in school, how they dealt with health care, how they looked for jobs, etc. So I thought a good way of doing this would be to volunteer to help tutor English at one of the English classes offered at the church. So I became friends with quite a lot of people in that class. But when I would ask them the questions from my interview questionnaire, I wasn't getting a lot of responses, so I went to some of the leaders of Notre Dame d'Haïti in Miami and explained this to them, and they said that maybe I should just take a step back and listen and let people start conversations with me and then try to, you know, ask them my questions. So one day, I went up to one of the women from the English class who I had seen every day for weeks and who was willing to give me an interview but was not very interested in the questions I was asking her. And one day I saw her standing inside of the church in Miami in front of a mural. And this mural depicts the Virgin Mary overlooking a boat of Haitian migrants leaving Miami. Now, I knew what this mural depicted, but I thought, well, because there's a boat of Haitian migrants in here, maybe I can get her to talk to me about how she migrated to the U.S. if I ask her to talk about this picture. So I said to her, will you explain to me what's in this mural? And so, of course, she described what I just described to you, what the mural has in it. And then I said to her, so did you come on a boat to the United States? And she looked at me and she said, yes, I did. But you know what? Jesus came with us on the boat. Mm-hmm. And I stood there not knowing exactly how to respond. But later on, when I continued my interview with her, I realized that what she was trying to do was to center her experience of being an exiled migrant from Haiti, to center that in a larger narrative, a narrative in which Jesus is present with them in their everyday struggles, and it's Jesus' presence with them through their sufferings and their trials that gives them a sense of meaning and a sense of hope, and in fact gives them the perseverance to keep struggling, to keep fighting. One other woman from that English class helped me understand this process more, because I said to her, you know, I see you praying a lot. Would you tell me what you pray for? And in my mind, I assumed that she must be asking God to help her get a job, resolve her questions around legal papers, help her children. And she said to me, well, first of all, when I pray, I give thanks to God, because if it wasn't for God, I wouldn't have made it here to begin with. If it wasn't for God, I wouldn't have had breakfast this morning. So first of all, I always have to give thanks for everything good in my life. And she said, and only after that do I even ask for what I need. She said, but you know, I don't pray just to ask for things I need, because every time one problem gets solved, 10 more come along. And then she used a very common Haitian proverb, which says, beyond the mountain, there's another mountain. So what she was expressing is that every time you solve one problem, 10 more come along. So prayer is not this, as I initially thought, this instrumental give and take between me and God. I need this, let me do this for God and he'll solve it. It's a relationship with a person, with a God that's present in our life, and it's his presence that gives that sense of hope that you can keep climbing up that next mountain. So the Haitians I spoke to did not have this, I think, very Western understanding sometimes that it's through faith and through religious practices that we will reach perfection here on earth. They would very clearly tell me, this world will never be perfect, but it's only because of my faith that I know I can keep going over the next mountain.
That's a really great observation, not only in terms of its substantive content, that you know, Haitian people take their faith seriously, and as the title of your book says, faith makes us live. But there's another level to this, and I want to talk a little bit about this, is the methodology. And this, you know, sounds a little bit too academically technical, but for students out there listening to this, this can become very important. And it's also interesting for other people who read books. It's not only the content that you get out of there, but understanding how we got this information out of there. Now, you decided to go and live in these communities. As you said, you worked in some social service programs in Miami. When you get to the chapter on Canada, you talk about how you're singing in the choir and that. What kind of methodological lessons did you learn of how we find out things as you did this study?
That's an excellent question. I learned, I think, that it's important to let our interview questions and questionnaires be flexible. I think it's important when you're beginning a research project to have a list of research questions and hence to have a list of interview questions that are going to help you answer those questions. But it's equally important to really pay attention to the narratives and the frames of the people that you're interviewing. And I think what I learned through the process of my research was that it was very important for me to immerse myself in these communities for an extended period of time. I actually lived I actually lived at the church in Miami for about 7 months, and as you mentioned, I sang in the Haitian Catholic choirs in Montreal and Paris, and I would spend, you know, days and evenings in these communities. And that was extraordinarily important for me because it took a long time for me to let go of a little bit of the frame and of the interpretations I had when I began my research and to actually begin to have what Max Weber called that sympathetic understanding, that understanding of what's going on in a community that can only come through an extended period of time of asking but also listening and paying attention to how people responded to me as well as to my questions. So the way that I write the book, and in particular the importance I give to not only the institutional part of religion but also the importance of individual faith, is certainly a narrative and interpretation that I only would have learned had I spent the amount of time living in those communities that I did.
I can hear that when you were discussing this a little bit earlier, and I've had very similar experiences when I did my research in Latin America, that as a young graduate student, fresh out of the classroom, you charge down with a rolled-up list of questions in your hand, and you're going to find out the answers to these, and you start talking to people, and they stare at you blankly, because their experience is not necessarily what yours is. And when you went down there, and I think this is a very important point to make, not only for academics, but also for people who read this type of work and the research and listen to the news on this stuff, is that if we try to, in many ways, force our questions onto our subjects, we can often have a huge blind spot to what is actually going on. And I'm thinking about this, what we talked about in our the earlier part of our interview here was how academics really forgot about the whole religion aspect. And that's not surprising. A number of academics tend to be very secular in their outlook. And so when they go into environment and somebody says, hey, this really matters to me religious, just, yeah, that's great. Now let's talk about, you know, the instrumental exchange of goods and services here. We can oftentimes miss that aspect. And you bring that up really well. There's some really great stories in your book. And I recommend people pick it up because it doesn't read like your typical jargonistic academic book. There's really neat stories about how you're in a room elbow to elbow with people and everybody starts singing songs and bringing people in. So it's very...
Thanks, Tony. And in fact, another methodological point I want to make to the graduate students and people there doing, people listening to this who do interviews, take good notes and if you can, record your interviews, because in fact it was only in reviewing my interview transcripts that I realized the huge gap between the frame I was presenting and the questions I asked and the responses I was getting. To give an example, when I interviewed, he's now actually Archbishop of Miami, the Polish-American priest who worked with the Haitian clergy to found Notre Dame d'Haïti, was a newly ordained priest, is now actually the Archbishop of Miami. And when I interviewed him about the work he had done decades before, all of my questions focused on the social service center. I asked him, you know, how did you get the funding to start the social service center? Who were your staff? And he interrupted me about three times to tell me the same thing. I began the Haitian community focusing on the Eucharist, he told me. I didn't start with social services. Social services came later. And it was only when I looked at that interview transcript years later did I realize that although he was pointing out to me the importance of the religious faith of the people he was serving, I would essentially keep turning the interview back to what I was interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And in my mind, I think it was only at a later interview in Montreal with another clergy member that he was so insistent that I had the wrong frame of understanding that it came across loud and clear, literally loud and clear, on the interview cassette, and he said to me, no, I don't think you get it. What I'm trying to tell you is that even if Haitians can get social services from the government or from here or from there, they're always going to think that the government is there because God put it there. For the Haitian people, everything is interpreted through the eyes of their faith. They don't separate out the material reality from the spiritual reality the way that we intellectuals tend to do. They don't see the world that way. They see everything in the world as being mediated through God's action in the world. And he said this to me very emphatically, and at the time I think I was quiet and tried to absorb what he was saying, but it really took me the field work process, which was almost 2 years long, as well as the study of those interviews for my dissertation. And then when I wrote the book, I went back and I reread all of my interview notes again. And it was only after this long process of reflection that I came to alter my frame to then understand and present, or at least what I think I do in the book, is present faithfully the narrative of the people who I interviewed and to bring that into dialogue with the way that sociologists tend to understand religion and focusing on the importance of institutions. So the final product, which is the book, is a combination of the interpretation and the frame that I began with, focusing on religious institutions, and combining that with what I discovered in my field work and in my interviews.
This definitely comes across in the book, and I read it that way. And it's an important lesson there that you're talking about how scholars and intellectuals in general really need to listen to their subjects a lot more than we do. We oftentimes, I fear, and I'm seeing this more as I get older, we go in with the answers and then we shape the interview or our research process in ways that will box people into those answers or will create that. And there's a danger to that. But let me challenge you a little bit on this methodology too, because is there a problem of becoming too close to your subjects? When I was reading your book, you're talking about going to birthday parties, you're talking about singing in the choir, you know, going home with individuals for dinner and that. Is there a danger Well, let me step back and say that, you know, part of our methodological training sometimes is that we're told that we need to be objective outside observers, dispassionate about our topic, and in many ways like a journalist. We're just journalists who do things a lot more slowly. Is there any danger of becoming too close to our subjects and that shades our view of things?
Well, these debates about social science methodology and the role of values or interest or personal views go back to the founding of the field, and people to this day continue to debate what it means to be an objective social science researcher. And what I discovered in my research process was that it was important for people to always understand that my position in the community was one of a researcher. Although I was attending birthday parties and helping out and singing in the choir, I wanted people to remember the purpose of me being there, which was to learn about their community and write about it. Sometimes I wondered when people were sharing things with me if they realized that this was a research process. So I would always make sure in the beginning, at the end of any interview or any conversation, I would ask for permission to share this, just to make sure that they hadn't forgotten just because I'm singing in the choir, that I'm going to write about my experience of singing in a choir. So in terms of the ethics, I think it's important when you plan on publishing and writing about your experiences to make sure that people understand who you are and why you're there. On the other hand, I realized that this concept of being an objective social science researcher who approaches her subject dispassionately, as you said, or as Durkheim said, with no preconceived notions, I realized that analytically, intellectually, this might make some sense. But in terms of a lived reality, as human beings, as persons, we have interests and we have passions and we relate to people intersubjectively. If I'm going to do an interview with somebody, I guess you could try to put on a face or a voice or a tone as an absolute outsider who knows nothing, but it made a lot more sense in the context of what I was doing to be subjectively interested in them as people, to show empathy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I tried very hard, as I explained, to not force particular types of answers on people, and I admit that there were times that in particular, my interviews with leaders in the beginning, where I had a particular frame and I had a hard time letting go of. But in many other of my interviews, when people shared with me deeply personal stories, and in fact shared with me extreme stories of hardship, economic hardship, not having legal papers, going through all these difficulties, in my heart, as a person, I wanted to reach out and try to do something for them, to help them find food to eat the next day or help them resolve their legal papers issues. But I realized that if I did that, I would be changing my role in the community, and I would no longer be a researcher. I would become more of a community activist or community social worker. And so I had to make many conscious choices to not change my position in the middle of this research. So I come to a conclusion or an understanding of the role of social science research that you can be empathetic, you can be understanding, and you can be sympathetic, but that doesn't mean that you give up your role as a researcher and as an outsider. So I think the way that I did my research is a middle ground between what's often portrayed as two extremes. Either you're totally objective or you're unable to see what's really going on because you're so sympathetic to the cause that you're studying. And I took a middle ground position on that.
It does come across very clearly in the book that way. And it is one of these challenges that affects a number of us who specifically study religion, because we often come at it with a religious background and our religious prejudice is there, or sometimes there are a number of scholars who are atheist and ardently so and come at religion with that framework. Interesting methodological lessons there. Let me pull us back into your book again and talk about your three different case studies, because I thought the study was absolutely fascinating. I learned a great deal about these different cities, these different religions. religious communities and the different ways that religious communities can be effective in these places. You start off with Miami, and that's where you have a very large immigrant community. So why don't you go ahead and give us the basic statistical lay of the land here for Miami. What is going on there?
As I mentioned earlier, Miami is the largest of the three communities I studied. In fact, it's the largest Haitian community of the diaspora. It's likely over 200,000 in South Florida, but throughout the state of Florida, many hundreds of thousands more. The history of the Haitian community in Miami was that it really began as a community of boat people with the accelerating political and economic crises in the 1970s. It's estimated that between 50 to 100,000 Haitians arrived in Miami by boat within a span of just a few years. So unlike other cities of the Haitian diaspora further north or in Paris, these were the least educated and the poorest Haitians who did not have the means to get on a plane and migrate further away. They came to the closest place they could get to. So this community really began with nothing. And it was the now Archbishop of Miami, Thomas G. Wenski, who was a young Polish-American priest, who reached out to help the Haitian clergy who were coming along with the Haitian boat people. And he founded a dual institution, Notre Dame d'Haïti Catholic Church, as well as the Pierre Toussaint Social Service Center. He founded that around 1981, and it was really around this two-tiered institution that occupies 10 acres of property in the Miami neighborhood now known as Little Haiti. It was around this two-tiered institution that Haitians moving to Miami began to settle. So it's not so much, if you think of it today, that the church picked the location because that's where people were moving. It's actually that Haitians arriving in Miami wanted to live in this area because they knew of this priest and because they knew of this community. So today's Haitian community in Miami, as I mentioned, is several hundred thousand. They are the poorest of all immigrants to Miami. As many of you know, Miami is a largely immigrant city. In fact, it's more than 50% of Miami is foreign-born. But even compared to other immigrants to Miami, Haitians are much poorer. They are also the most religious of all immigrants to Miami. In survey research done on children of immigrants in Miami, Haitian parents and Haitian adolescents were the most likely to say that they had attended religious services in the previous week. So Haitians are the poorest but also the most religious of all immigrants in Miami.
Tell me a little bit about this institution, the Notre Dame d'Haïti Catholic Church and the Toussaint Center. You gave us a little bit of the history of this thing. What kind of activities are they engaged in today or the past 10 years?
Well, I mentioned that this center was founded by Thomas G. Wenski, and I mentioned that he's Polish-American. And the reason that's relevant is that he knew the history of the Catholic Church working with immigrants in the United States through his own Polish background. And he set out to replicate this model of the ethnic community being founded on the church and a social service center. So he started, as he insisted to me, he started first the religious community. He built the community based on the Eucharist. And then he very strategically took advantage of the many educated lay Catholics who were coming to Miami who had a lot of experience doing social work in Haiti. As I mentioned before, the government in Haiti has never been very strong, so most education, social services, even political work has been done through religious organizations. So although the majority of Haitians arriving in Miami were not very highly educated, there was also a large group of middle-class Haitians who had extensive experience teaching literacy, giving assistance in child care, etc. So Bishop Wenski had a group of lay leaders to draw on to begin these services. He began with English language literacy classes as well as legal assistance. Then they expanded. They got grants from Head Start and began a daycare center on the first floor of the Toussaint Center. They had services helping people with their health care, so sort of the whole array of what you would expect to get. And his idea was that Notre Dame and the Toussaint Center should be a one-stop center where people could come and have someone to help them with both their spiritual as well as a variety of their material needs all in one place. So this essentially was the center of the Haitian community for decades. Now the Toussaint Center has grown so much that it's moved its offices further away, and the church has expanded so much that it's taken over the space that used to be occupied by the Toussaint Center. And in fact, the church, which previously occupied an old cafeteria of a school, after 30 years of existence, is now finally going to break ground and actually building a new church building. So what Bishop Wenske started 30 years ago expanded enormously, and he was very adept at combining funding from agencies like Catholic Charities with funding from government agencies such as Head Start, as well as from private agencies like the United Way. So he had a vision, he had leaders, and he was able to attract funds from both the Catholic Church, the Archdiocese, as well as from the local and the state and even the federal government.
And this becomes an important aspect of understanding Miami in relation to your two other cases, because I know in Montreal and then in Paris, there's declining ability of working with the government to get assistance or working in partnership with them.
Yes, this is the largest contrast that I found in my research. In Quebec, the Haitian community had, in its initial phase, a relatively similar story to that of Miami. Haitian clergy founded a Haitian Catholic mission, which actually has the same name as that in Miami, Notre Dame d'Haïti, and they founded a social service center called the Office of the Haitian Christian Community of Montreal. And as I mentioned, because of the extensive ties between the institutional Catholic Church in Quebec with Haiti, these Haitian priests who migrated to Montreal were able to mobilize resources from the Archdiocese of Montreal as well as from religious orders in Quebec, such as the Spiritans or the Jesuits, to fund these programs for Haitians. And they were also quite successful at getting government funding through the 80s and through the 90s. But really, as immigration to Quebec began to diversify, Haitians were the largest immigrant group moving to Quebec throughout the 1970s and the 1980s. And they received quite a lot of assistance from the Catholic Church as well as from the government, and they often worked together to help Haitians.
Mm-hmm.
But this all began to change. By around 2000, the largest immigrant groups coming to Quebec were now, well, there's just a great diversity of them. Many of them are coming also from North Africa, from the Middle East. And so with this increasing cultural and religious diversity, the government in Quebec began to question its practice of cooperating with immigrants' religious service institutions. So the leaders of the Haitian Christian organization in Montreal actually took the word Christian out of their name because they feared that despite decades of success in helping Haitians integrate, the fact that they had their roots in a Christian identity would hurt them in attaining government funds.
Now, from the side of the government, was this the idea that, well, since we have such diversity now, we don't want to show favoritism to any one particular group, and so we're going to decide not to show favoritism to anybody?
There are really two viewpoints in Quebec on this. One viewpoint is essentially what you just expressed, that in a context of religious diversity, we need to make sure we're not giving favoritism to one religion over another. The other viewpoint is rooted more in a concept of we need to move closer to the French system of laïcité, a secularism that seeks to push religion out of the public sphere. So these two viewpoints, let's be welcoming to religion without favoring anyone in particular, versus religion is a problem for social integration. These two viewpoints get debated in Quebec. And so a lot of the ways that the laws regarding immigrant institutions or religious institutions, a lot of the ways that the laws get put into practice depends on the viewpoint of the government official in charge at that point in time.
Now, you talked about something going on in Canada, or specifically Quebec, as the Quiet Revolution. And what was that, and how did that factor into all this?
Well, I also was relatively unknowledgeable about Quebec prior to beginning this research. And I didn't realize that in the 1960s, Quebec underwent a process that's called the Quiet Revolution, which is similar in some ways to what happened in the French Revolution, that there was an ideology of the need to separate Quebec society and government from the dominance of Catholic institutions. And it's called the Quiet Revolution because it wasn't violent like the French Revolution.
And yeah, nobody got their head cut off, right?
No. Okay. And in fact, many intellectuals, Catholic intellectuals and clergy, participated actively in this process of separation of church and state, you could say. So at the same time that Quebec was trying to emphasize its Francophone identity and its unique cultural heritage, it was also trying to separate out Catholicism and Catholic institutions from the government, from the state. So from the 1960s to the 1970s, this transformation was rapid and it was very thorough. So there was this creation of large French-speaking bureaucracies of social welfare, education, health, etc. They created all of these government institutions to replace the types of social work the Catholic Church had done for the previous 200 years in Quebec.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things to note about this, or that I thought about as well when you were talking about the Quiet Revolution, is I thought back to the United States here and how there's been a great deal of concern in religious communities that the government is pushing religion out of the public square to a great extent. But what we see in Miami is that there's still pretty significant partnerships between local, state, and even federal government in assisting immigrants via the Notre Dame Center, that or the Toussaint Center that is run there, as compared to France, where the government really is withdrawing. What kind of particular challenges does that leave for the Catholic Church in the bureau, as you call them, or the Notre Dame Christian community in Montreal? What kind of challenges does that pose for them to undertake their activities?
Well, what I argue in the book is that all three of the countries I studied have separation of church and state of some form or another. There is an institutional differentiation between government and the church in the U.S. The difference is that in the U.S., this institutional differentiation between church and state has largely been understood to be cooperative, that this institutional differentiation is good for both sides, and when both sides have common goals, they can cooperate to try to achieve them. Now, in France and in Quebec, the understanding of this institutional differentiation is that it was only achieved through great conflict with the Catholic Church. So the government's approach to institutional differentiation is one of more of a narrative of conflict, that in order to maintain the separation of spheres, there needs to be not cooperation with, but rather a pushing of religion out of the public sphere. So that narrative is much more common in Quebec and France than you would find it in the U.S. So what happens when Haitians move to France is that it's very hard to talk about religion or a Catholic or a Christian organization in the public sphere and get any legitimacy. So, interestingly, a lot of Haitian leaders who themselves are personally very religious or who run organizations that have informal ties to the church will simply cover this up. And when they apply for government funding, they will cover up their religious ties. But again, as I mentioned, because I spent a lot of time doing field work, I realized that the Haitian organization that has done the most work to help Haitians in Paris, it's called Haiti Development. This organization grew out of the Haitian Catholic Mission of Paris, and the leader of Haiti Development was also a leader of the Haitian Catholic Mission.
Tell us a little bit about that organization, the history of that one. Now, we're in Paris right now, so we went from Miami to Montreal, now we're in Paris. So give us an idea what the Catholic Church is doing there.
Well, prior to around 1980, there were only a few thousand Haitians living in France, and they mostly had French citizenship, had studied in France, and had jobs in France. So when more working-class Haitians began to arrive, they organized the Haitian Catholic community of Paris. And one of those Haitian intellectuals who had lived in Paris for a long time, René Benjamin, was an active member of the Haitian Catholic community. And he took it as his mission to start an organization to help the newly arriving Haitians with their legal papers, with learning French, with accessing welfare benefits, health care, etc. So Mr. Benjamin, for about 20, 30 years, ran Haiti Development. And now he did get some funding from the government. The only thing he got funding from the government for was actually to assist Haitians in applying for political asylum. France has a relatively open political asylum process, but it takes a lot of help to understand how to make those applications. So that was his number one priority, was helping Haitians fleeing the economic and political upheaval in Haiti to apply to legalize their status. Now, he wanted to do similar things as to what had happened in Montreal and Miami, and in fact, he knew the clergy and the lay leaders of the Haitian communities in Montreal and Miami. And he desired to begin an organization that would be like what the Toussaint Center is or what the Bureau of the Haitian Christian Community of Montreal once was. But he was unable to, because without that cooperation from the government, without access to outside resources, he of his own volunteer work and the volunteer work of the people in the church was not sufficient. So that's one of the points that I make in my book, is that immigrant leaders, and Catholic lay leaders and clergy who are seeking to help Haitians integrate, they can't do it just with their own resources. What's key about Catholic Church is the extent to which they can mediate between the Haitian community and the state and combine resources from different sources in order to help Haitians access the type of spiritual and material support that they need.
Even small and subtle differences where the state becomes a little bit more standoffish can have a huge impact on how difficult or easy it is to help a number of these communities, I would imagine. There's one other aspect in your comparison between Miami, Montreal, and Paris that I found interesting. Again, as a political scientist, I was very interested in focusing on the church-state relations that went on there and how that affected everything. But you also talked about the theological themes that ran through each of these communities. Tell us a little bit about that and whether they were different or similar.
I found the theological themes to be similar across the three sites. What I talk about in my book, and as I've described in this interview, what first really struck me was how people would describe God's presence in their daily life. So there's really an incarnational theology, an understanding of the real presence of God all throughout one's life. So this was very interesting to me. The other theme that was really highlighted, even celebrated in all three of these communities, was the theme of Jesus suffering on the cross. Although Jesus suffering and dying on the cross is a theological belief of most Christians, if not all, it's not always that emphasized, but in part because Haitians have struggled so much and continue to struggle, this idea that suffering has a meaning, and it has a meaning because Jesus died and rose from the dead, that theme was lived out in processions on Good Friday. It came out in interviews, and it really struck me, I think, as a contrast to even how many Westerners who believe in Christianity, who are professed Christians, struggle with this idea of suffering, because the idea of suffering clashes with the idea of modernity and progress and the ability to perfect the world, which is an Enlightenment idea which permeates much of intellectual thought and I think even much of Christianity in the West. So this understanding of suffering as redemptive is a big theme of my book, and that's why on the cover of my book, it's a reenactment of the crucifixion of Jesus that happened on Good Friday at Notre Dame d'Haïti.
That theme really does come across very strong, and is one of the interesting aspects that I picked up on the book, as I've emphasized a couple times already now, that I read it for the institutional aspects. Oh, Paris is different because of laïcité, and there's the government's more standoffish, so you're not going to have as effective responses. The thread that also ties all these different communities together is the strength of the faith of the individuals in each of these communities, which really seems to make these organizations work. So as a political scientist, I look at the government and church relationships here and say, yeah, that's some of the problem. But you really bring out the fact that the individuals there, their own faith beliefs and how they interact in that community is really what makes these things vibrant and makes communities function.
Well, I think that there are two important things I hope people will learn by reading my book. One, I think that these three Haitian communities that I studied can teach us something about how to deal with suffering and can lead us to question some of our own ways of understanding things. And the second, more intellectual question, which is about these institutional differences between religion and state across the three sites, I'm not the first scholar to point out that there are differences in how the United States, Quebec, and France understand separation of church and state. However, I'm one of the few examples I'm aware of that looks at how those institutional differences at a macro level actually impact the integration of a particular immigrant group. And so what I argue in my book is that ultimately this model of cooperation between church and state is more conducive to both the symbolic as well as the socioeconomic integration of Haitians in the U.S., as opposed to the model of really assertive secularism in France, which separates so starkly immigrants' religious lives and communities from the state that it actually weakens the ability of one important community institution to work with Haitians. Now, I am very clear that I do not think religious institutions by themselves can integrate immigrants. But what I'm saying is that for a disadvantaged group of people like Haitian immigrants, the religious community is often the strongest resource that they themselves have. And by ignoring or excluding that institution, they're creating an unnecessary gap. Mm-hmm. In Montreal, it's a similar story. As Montreal becomes more religiously diverse and they think about how to accommodate different religions, I think that they would do well to look at not only the French model of separation in church and state, which so often becomes assertively anti-religious, but to also look at the U.S. model, which shows very clearly how church and state can be institutionally separate yet cooperate to work on common social goals.
Are there any, you know, I want to finish off as this being our last question here as we're running out of time. Do you think there's any lessons that could be pulled from your research on religious communities that could perhaps make secular organizations that do similar work all the more effective?
Well, I think that, as John Paul II has said, and even more recently, Pope Benedict, the Catholic Church thinks of itself as an expert in humanity. So when the Catholic Church does social services, Pope Benedict has written about the different meanings of charity, and so I think that secular service organizations who are doing charity would do well to think of the whole person, and in dealing with that person to understand that that person may have an immediate material need, but they also have dignity, and they also want to be an agent, and they want to be able to give something. So part of social welfare or doing charity is not only giving, but teaching people how to become more active agents in their own well-being. And similarly, religious organizations can learn much from secular organizations. There are excellent social service organizations out there that do not have a religious heritage. So I think that the field of social services, whether it's the U.S., Canada, and France, will always be populated by groups of people who have come together around a common interest, which may be a religious one, but it could also be a secular one. And I think that it's looking at each other and understanding each other's strengths and weaknesses that each can do things better. Now, ultimately, I do argue that social service organizations that have an understanding of the religious dimension of a person can use that religious understanding itself as a resource, and that to be blind to the spiritual needs and interests of people and to only focus on their material needs can often sometimes have the opposite impact of what we're trying to achieve. You can give someone material help, but not help their human dignity. And similarly, with all the attention that went to Haiti after the earthquake, I made that point in several op-eds that I wrote, that in our rush to want to help Haiti, are we willing to go slowly and to listen? And are we willing to do our social work in Haiti, whether it's a secular organization or a religious organization? Are we willing to take the time and the effort that it requires to activate the agency of the people that we're trying to help? Because charity, as Pope Benedict has said, is a two-way road. It's not me giving to you. It's a relationship of mutual, reciprocal exchange. And if we don't understand that, then we're not doing social work as well as we could.
Well, very important lesson, and we will finish up on that note today. My guest has been Margarita Mooney. She's the author of Faith Makes Us Live, Surviving and Thriving in the Haitian Diaspora. Margarita, thank you for being a guest on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.